So let me be even more careful than this morning for two reasons. First, the results I'm going to show are very recent, like, you know, less than 6 months. So interpretation is still very questionable. Second, in the business of Bose-Einstein condensation of exciton, and this is the last time I'm going to say Bose-Einstein condensation of exciton in my talk, for the last 25 years, there have been claim and retraction and claim and fight and so on. So every time there is a possible interpretation of what we have been doing, I will take the most pessimist views and not claim anything, okay? So I will call this macroscopic coherence and transport in degenerate exciton gas. And there is two pieces of work. One is condensation in the traps in the plane of the quantum world. And the other one is observation of rings that are ordered. And in fact, I look forward from your comments because many things are completely unsettled yet. So can we turn off this? Oh, it's there, okay. So a little bit about the question of condensation. Tell you about the sample design and properties, and then those question of condensation in plane. I'll show you a movie. For me, it was I looked all my life for this movie, so I'm very happy about the movie.
Seen it, and I hardly seen it.
and then some other state of exciton. So finish by open questions. So this started long time ago by Keldysh, and he made the observation long time ago that if exciton are far away, they can be considered as boson. And then he noticed that if, because the mass is so light, in fact, lighter than the mass of the free electron, the TC should be, you know, several orders of magnitude higher than for atoms, okay? And that triggered the whole mess. So everybody thought they were able to see condensation of exciton. There is several serious problems. First, if you want to have condensation, you need to have many of them. And then you start to see the underlying Fermi statistics. So you can start to separate from the Bose behavior. We already discussed this a little bit this morning. At high density, you have the mode transition, so screening will unbind the exciton and there are no more bound states. Exciton recombine, so there is a lifetime, and therefore you want them to cool before they disappear. So the question is, can they couple to the phonon effectively? And also, in normal structure, exciton tend to make bi-exciton, and bi-exciton make electron hole droplet and so on, and therefore everything collapse and you don't have a gas of exciton anymore. So after 31 years, this has not been observed. In terms of the theory, what Keldysh was able to show is that in all cases, assuming you can still keep exciton as exciton so that they don't unbind, they behave like boson at low density, so then the condensation is really like BEC. But at high density, they behave like a BCS state where the coupling is due to Coulomb and not to to the Frohlich interaction.
Okay.
Yes.
Just a question concerning the list of difficulties that you mentioned in the
previous
transparency. In your view, what is the more severe one? Are they all equally severe, or what are the?
I think the cooling is the most severe one, because you really want to be able to go to, you know, millikelvin before they disappear, and there is a trick in the sample that we are using, where. But then the question is.
So this is to have a time scale which is long enough so that I can consider the excitons as being conserved in number, right?
So that right. And to low temperature. So,
right.
But then the question is exactly where is in the phase diagram if you put the, let's say, temperature versus density, you have a separation between Bose and non-Bose. Where exactly do you stand? And for example, a good friend of mine, Jim Wolf, has been working on copper oxide for many years. And Jim has published many papers claiming being very close to Bose-Einstein condensation. Because he was estimating his density using some numbers taken from the literature. Finally, last year, he decided to measure himself the Auger recombination, which means two excitons bumped together, one is promoted up, the other one is promoted down. And he found that the number of literature was about two orders of magnitude larger, smaller than the reality, so he was never in the regime of Bose-Einstein condensation. And Jim was honest enough to publish a paper in PRB where he put everything, including his own mistakes. When do you cross the boundary between a condensation of boson and some kind of collective effect? I don't know.
But it's not only just a two-dimensional phase.
No, it's much more complicated.
And temperature, because there is the question of time scale, right?
There is time scale, and if you want to put a magnetic field, and I mean, you can, But time scale is very important.
Under conservation.
Time scale is very important.
For neither of the two phases, I think. Found experimentally?
Up to now, never.
Both of them.
Well, I want to say, I mean, I hate to say never in physics. Unambiguous observation, not yet. Okay, let's pass about the other one, okay. So how do we avoid some of those issues? The idea is to take couple quantum wells, and with a distance between the two quantum wells small, much smaller than the Bohr radius. So typically, in gallium arsenide, the Bohr radius is 12.5 nanometers. Here, this thickness in our sample, this is only 4 nanometers, and each one of them is 8 nanometers. So this is within one orbit of a bulk exciton. If you don't put any electric field perpendicular, then you have those direct excitons. And when I say direct, this is in real space, not in k-space. Okay? And those behave like usual two-dimensional systems. If you put a large electric field, then the bands are tilted like this. And you see that the lowest state now is this indirect exciton. So with electron is one in one quantum well and the hole in the other quantum well. And this produces a lot of interesting things. First, you have a two-dimensional exciton, but you have a three-dimensional sample. So the phonon are three-dimensional, the exciton is two-dimensional. You have a very strong coupling between the phonon and the exciton. So the cooling rate is increased by a factor of about 10 to the 3. Second, now we have dipole, because this is minus, this is plus. All those guys are with a dipole oriented perpendicular to the quantum well. Therefore, they repel each other. And this has several advantages. It limits the screening, they cannot get close to make the mode transition. It prevents the collapse to a liquid. It reinforces the tendency to condensation. And because as you increase the density, the energy goes a bit higher, they can move much easier because then the energy is higher than the fluctuation in the plane. So this has a lot of advantage in terms of looking for some potential condensation. The first paper was published by the group from the IBM lab in Tokyo in 1990, but at that time the sample were extremely poor quality. Leonid Butov, who is now at Berkeley, worked a lot in the last 4 years and developed very, very good sample with Art Gossard. Now, as you're all theorists, you're going to tell me, but in two dimension, there is no BEC at high temperature.
The constant is a thousand transition.
Yes, sure. There could be a power law order parameter, could be super fluidity. Okay. This is just to give you numbers about the coupling between two-dimensional exciton and 3D. So we can show that the temperature can get down to about 0.4 Kelvin in about 5 nanoseconds, and the lifetime is milliseconds, so this is okay. So the sample are things like this, where we etch mesas and put some contact, so we can put a field perpendicular. The quantum wells are embedded in gallium arsenide. If the sample was the sample is not exactly symmetrical in the sense that this electrode is different from the top electrode. So depending of the two direction, we have slightly different results. And when you apply a field, you have, as I said, the electron and the hole in two different quantum wells, making the lowest level. Now, because of this, there is a dipole between the interaction within the dipole, between the exciton. So when you look at the luminescence at low density and high density, you see a shift of the luminescence. And this can be explained very easily. If I take one exciton interacting with a 1 over r to the cube with the other exciton, you see that we can have a shift of the line width. And if we take this, this is integrated between a short distance cutoff, because at short distance the dipole-dipole load breaks down to infinity. So if we take this of the order of the distance between the quantum well, we get a formula that is exactly the same as if you were using a classical capacitor plate for the two quantum wells. So using this, we can now, when we look at the luminescence, locally have an idea of the density within 30%. And that's the linear type of photoluminescence. No voltage, the line width is very nice, you know, less than the 1 MeV. Then you apply the voltage. At the beginning, there is not much change, and then suddenly the indirect exciton become the lower states, and you see the change of the energy. And even at high field, the line width is very, very good. The lifetime goes from a few hundred picoseconds to hundreds of nanoseconds. So to try to address this question of the two dimension, we started to look at traps. So first thing is, as you know, even Art Gossard cannot control the thickness to better than one monolayer. So the best quantum well have one monolayer fluctuation that are unavoidable. And therefore the energy in certain island is lower than in some other island. And then because we have, and therefore the potential landscape that the exciton see is some kind of something like this, okay? And if for best good sample, this should not be more than two monolayers. Now, if you have some charge, because we are putting electrode on the top and the bottom, then you will have something that look more that, like a real landscape with mountains and lakes. And therefore, someplace there should be some exciton lakes. Okay? And then you look at the equation and you find that even for two-dimensional potential or for a 2D box, there is a transition. It is much higher than for atoms, and both of them goes to zero when those either S or omega, S go to infinity or omega go to zero. So this was the motivation for us to make many MESA and look if there was some traps. So this is one picture. This is just taken with a camera, and you see that we excite the whole MESA with a very broad laser, CW laser, and all the light come from one point. So already this is very interesting. It means that electron and holes make exciton and come here. So this is for a uniform. You see that the trap is with cylindrical symmetry. So rather than plotting something at three dimension, I'm going to show the position along one direction. It was taken along x. The frequency of the light, and then the intensity. Okay. So this is the indirect exciton line. We don't see any direct exciton. This is some emission coming from the gallium arsenide substrates. You have seen the sample, so if there is light coming from the trap, it will excite the gallium arsenide under, and there is some light coming out. Okay, and as a function of position, you see the excitons are almost not emitting over 500 micron, but they're all concentrated at position of this trap. So then you ask yourself, how do they move here? And one way to do this is to excite with a laser spot away from the trap.
And you expect some specific optical signal if there is
a I'm looking for the smoking gun. I have not yet found the smoking gun. Even I have a question for you, theorist. Is there a smoking gun? Maybe we can discuss this at the end. Is there a smoking gun? So this is much more interesting. So now we excite around here. You see there is indirect exciton in the at the spot of the laser, and this excitation is strong enough to excite the substrate. And then the exciton disappear. There is almost no more exciton. That's very important because it means that the exciton are now traveling. And when they travel, they go out of the radiation zone. And therefore, they acquire enough momentum to be able to move very far away from where they were created in the first place. And then they collect here. And then there is a very strong emission from the trap, although we are exciting very far away from the trap. So that starts to look something that is interesting. Looking from the top, you see that this trap, by the way, those traps are very special traps. There are about a couple of them per square millimeter. We don't know exactly what they are. I have a student whose full PhD is going to be to understand what the traps are. It's most likely a combination of fluctuation of the quantum well plus some impurity that are due to the doping of the structure. So one interesting thing is that if you move in terms of the distance, you see that the luminescence starts at one place and then shifts slightly. Position is changing here. And then there is another peak coming up and become very large here, and so on. So if you plot the intensity, you see this very strong peak, so very localized, about 25 micron in diameter. And then the energy has two parts. One with the usual or regular indirect exciton line, and then something like this, and it's almost like an harmonic potential, but with a peak in the center. So we believe that excitons are collected, they come in, and then the intensity, the density increase, then the line width change, and therefore there is a increase of the energy of the exciton close one to the other. As a function of temperature, there is a very sharp behavior in terms of the size of the exciton cloud. At 15 Kelvin, you see it's very, very big. And then as you lower the temperature, become very sharp and become very small. And the peak intensity has this this behavior, almost like some kind of a threshold around 7 Kelvin. Right now, we are able to get 1.6 Kelvin. No, at the time of this, so we have built a helium-3 insert, and when I left the lab Saturday, we were down to 0.4 Kelvin, and I hope that within a week or two, we should be at 0.3 Kelvin. At that point, we should have a much better sense of the if there is a transition or not. But if you start to look at the way the exciton collects in the trap, it's not too bad. It starts to look like really a condensation. It's really, this is versus temperature. So the temperature change here, and you see the collection of the exciton. So we try to put some number. There is at least 4 × 10⁵ excitons that are collected in this small volume. There is an unambiguous transport of excitons over a distance of a few hundred microns. Is there Bose condensation? So if we take the formula for an ideal non-interacting point-like boson in thermodynamic equilibrium, I don't know if you can do this, but suppose in a perfect box with this kind of density, we find that the transition temperature should be 0.7 Kelvin. We are at 1.6, therefore we cannot claim anything related to any Bose condensation. Nevertheless, I have to be a bit careful because the excitons are strongly interacting, they are not in equilibrium, and they are in an open system because we put energy, they recombine, so this is not an equilibrium system. I want to say that this is reproducible and extremely stable. When I say stable, can last for 3-4 days. As long as there is helium in the cryostat, this doesn't move. Absolutely reproducible, done on many samples, all coming from the 2 or 3 wafer coming from Artgosart, but on many different samples. So we started to scratch our heads and decided to make a movie. Can we turn off the light because it's an amateur movie, it's not a very good. I hope it will work. So we went first to increase the density of the laser, and you see the wind of exciton, and the wind move, the wind find the trap, collect around the trap, make some kind of a ring, and then it's going to fill up the trap, and now the trap is full. Okay, and then we now are going to decrease the intensity. The trap is going to start to empty itself. The fact that it's a ring shows that the trap is really like a levitating ball, okay? And then the exciton wavefront is moving back, and the density goes down, and there is less and less exciton, and they are absorbed, okay? Now we move the laser spots, and you see that this is out of the MESA, you see the MESA boundary, and then it always turns toward the laser spot, so there is a wind of exciton coming in. You see that there is no light here because the exciton are now moving so fast they cannot emit light. Okay, and then there is this ring that is appearing. And you notice that the ring is modulated. There is some modulation of the ring. This is versus temperature. High temperature, there is many phonons, nothing happened, but then we lower the temperature, then now the exciton can move farther and farther away, farther, farther away, and then they're going to fill the trap, and they're going to make a ring around this trap. And again, you see the ring is not really, now showing that this is only for indirect exciton, we change the gate voltage. So when the voltage is zero, there is only direct exciton, nothing happens. When we put a negative gate voltage, indirect exciton can move away and move. So, well, for me, at my age, I've worked on exciton for 20 years, seeing a wind of exciton is great. So I don't know the interpretation, but that's very beautiful. So we said, maybe the trap is not so important after all. So we move away from the trap on this sample, or take a sample where there is no trap, and that's what we observe. Now,
there are also samples in which there is no trap.
Sorry?
There are also samples.
Yes, because I say a couple per square square millimeter, so we cut this about 500 microns, so sometimes there is one trap or two, sometimes there is no trap. Okay. And this is not under control, okay? So what we see is the laser excitation. Then there is a first ring bright, then a ring that is completely opaque. an external ring that is fragmented with very bright circular fragments. Okay. Sometimes there is some fixed bright defect. And I say fixed because if we move the laser spots, all these structures move with the laser, but those guys, and I'll show you some picture after, do not move. So those could be some kind of fluctuation of the potential where the recombination is easier. And it's important because you see they are in the dark ring. So it means that there is exciton here between this ring and this ring, and the fixed spots help them to recombine so they appear. Otherwise, I will not know that there is exciton in the ring.
Where is the laser spot in this in the red?
Yeah. Okay. And then outside there is nothing. Okay. If one of those spots is put outside, it will not light up. Now this is macroscopic. In this experiment, it's 200 microns. So this is about 600 microns. We have done experiment up to 1 millimeter. So we have spent 6 months looking at this. This is versus temperature. So you change temperature in 15 steps between 15 Kelvin and 1.7 Kelvin, and you see that the external ring become sharper and sharper, and then completely fragmented. The reason why it's moving a little bit is because we turn the cryostats, fix the temperature, and then make a measurement, and so on. So this is summarized here. First, the photoluminescence. In the laser spot, there is direct exciton and indirect exciton. And this is the excitation profile. This is the direct exciton profile. The direct exciton are localized and stay close to the excitation spot. Then the indirect exciton, their energy change with density. And in the external ring, they are higher density, so the energy is different. And you see the profile. At low in excitation, there is a bump here. And then this is smooth without anything special. Then we lower the temperature. This go up. This first effect, I think, could be understood rather intuitively. So here we start to see that something is happening here. Then you see the green curve. There is a trough here and a bump here. Red curve, the trough go to zero. This bump is higher. Black curve, then this is really stronger intensity. And the way you could interpret this is that here we create very high density of high energy exciton. They move out, the temperature goes down as they cool, they go move out, but also the density goes down. So at some point in the travel, the number of exciton in the radiation zone, because the only thing we measure are, what we measure is the luminescence. We have no other way to measure this. In the radiation zone is increased. So this could be explained, I would say, with back of the envelope calculation. This we have absolutely no idea. So now we are going to go to the lowest temperature and change the intensity. Oh no, let me first show something. This is a series of measurements at different distance from the central spot at high temperature and low temperature. And you see the direct exciton, the indirect exciton, and the substrate of gallium arsenide. Here the indirect exciton exists everywhere and the energy shifts slightly. So there is higher density here than here, but there is no trough. Here you see the energy also change, but the line becomes sharper and sharper, disappear here, and reappear in the external ring. And if we look at the change of energy between here and here, it's about 3 MeV. So there is two things that contribute to the transport of the exciton. One is diffusion. There is a lot of exciton at one point, so the delta N make them move out. But also because when they are close, they have a higher energy, there is a drift. There is an energy hill that tries to push them away. So that's why they are moving out of the laser spot. Let's look at the fragmentation. So it is extremely sensitive to temperature. This is an example where we take the intensity of the PL on this ring. At low temperature, you see very sharp spots. By the way, it doesn't go to zero. So even between the spots, between those fragments, there is some emission, but it's not as strong. The modulation can be about 30%. But you go from 1.8 to 4.7, it's almost done. At 7 Kelvin, it is completely dead. So there is a very sharp transition between this older fragmented ring and some kind of just aureole around the laser spot. Let's look at the fragments. First, they are almost exactly circular, okay, to the best of what we can measure. Second, let's go back here. I can plot the position of the fragment as a function of the number of fragments. Okay? And this is almost exactly a straight line. So they are exactly order and they occupy the maximum space on the ring. It's a perfectly periodic ring. And as I said before, there is a big difference of intensity here and here, but there is luminescence coming from between the rings. Now the most interesting aspect is when you change intensity. And here the ring is distorted because the edge of the mesa are here. Okay, let me show it again, because beginning it's circular. You see the bright spots, and then at the end, and let's start again, because try to see, look at one of those bright spots, and you will see that it is not visible when it is outside of the ring, and only become visible when it is inside of the ring. You see? And then pop this guy, pop, then this one, then this one. So those defects tell us that there is, in fact, exciton between here and here, but they cannot emit light. As a function of when, then you can go on one of those diagonal and measure this, and you see that you have this is at a certain intensity, then you see the first ring appearing, and then it moves out, and those distances are typically, in this case, it will be 180 microns, so the diameter is more than a millimeter. And typical density that we can evaluate from the exciton luminescence, the position of the luminescence, is a few times 10 to the 10 per square centimeter, plus or minus 30%. Okay, this is another experiment. Now we have two spots and we move one. Okay, and you see that each spot moves with its own ring, and there is, again, you will see that some of those bright spots here appear only when they are within the one ring and then disappear after. Okay, so that's a three-dimensional. I have a Russian student who is an expert with pictures and so on. So this is the... But it's experimental data. It's no fudging. It's real experimental data. So that's beautiful. So this is the center of the spots. This is the external ring. Some of those defects inside, and then the periodicity. So what can we say? This effect is seen only for the indirect exciton, nothing associated with the normal exciton. There is a very sharp temperature dependence, disappear completely above 3 Kelvin. Okay. Because we excite well above the gallium aluminium arsenide barrier, the coherence of the laser is completely lost. So if there is coherence or order, whatever, it is spontaneously appearing. It is not due to the laser light. Like this morning, I was talking about coherence induced by the laser light. So our current back of the envelope, just interpretation, is that we create exciton and electron hole at very high energy by the laser. They move out, As I said, by diffusion, drift, and maybe some phonon wind. There are some good theoretical paper by Tikhofeyev and other guys about the wind of the phonon wind that should go with transport of charge. So we don't know about this. So they acquire enough kinetic energy to move out of the light cone. So this is the dark ring. The fact that there is those spots here and that they are fixed reveal that there is dark exciton between the two rings. Then the energy relaxation reduces the number of indirect exciton and reduces the temperature as the ring increases. And at some optimal distance, there is the condition for forming a macroscopically ordered state. If you ask me what are those conditions, I don't know. The only thing I can say is that a certain distance. And then there must be some kind of a stimulated recombination because all the excitons disappear outside of this ring. So let me now try a tentative interpretation. I say tentative and I will immediately show that it is very tentative. So let me go back. This is the K-space, those are the parabola for 1s exciton, 2s, and then the continuum. So this is given by the mass, total mass of the center of mass. And this is the photon cone. And we know that only the excitons that are within the radiation zone can emit light. So we only see the density of excitons that are localized within this cone. So that's where we create them in the first place. Then they quickly emit phonons, go out of, still in the central spot, out of the radiation zone, and then go down here, and then they start to emit lights in this region. Then, as we said before, because the density is high, they can diffuse and drift. And that explains the first bright spot and the first ring. By the way, if you put the numbers, the exciton all degenerates with a degeneracy factor of about 0.3. Then they move out, and that explains the fact that they are no more in the radiative zone, so they have some kind of inactive ring. And then I would like to dream that they are going back to the center with some kind of a condensation or superfluidity or something like this, and they recombine all of them. Now I want to be careful. If what I said is right, that there is several ways of describing this. People talk about vortices, other people speak about the soliton necklace. These have been seen for atomic Bose-Bernstein condensation. If this is due to some kind of a superfluidity, then there is a quantum coherence. Now, remember, we are in an open system. And people have seen periodic vortices in classical system only because they are described by nonlinear differential equation. And in fact, the first observation that I've been able to find, maybe there is one earlier, is 1923. Okay, so at this point, we don't have a smoking gun. I'm sure that there is an order state of exciton on macroscopic dimension. It is associated with transport of the exciton, and I don't know exactly what it is. And I stop here.
So those droplets, are the regions where you think the Bose condensation takes place? I mean, or is it more like a phase separation? That
first, Gabi, let's be I have not said okay. That they are, okay?
Okay, but
No.
The
I mean,
drops, is it because there's some residual interaction? Let's not talk about superfluidity. I mean, it likes to phase separate. I mean, why does it form those?
I think there is a higher density here, but there is higher density here. What is very surprising and still not explained is why is it fragmented and so regular?
Right.
Okay. So if and now I'm completely interpreting. You know, I'm born on the Mediterranean Sea, so with my hand and so on. If those are vortices, they're going to repel each other.
But the vortices where there is light or where there isn't light?
This.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And therefore, they're going to start to occupy the maximum space, and there will be a perfect periodicity around.
So the dark regions is where the Bose condensation or the superfluid would take place?
No,
it's not be. No.
Somehow should be when the light, when
exactly,
you see light.
Exactly.
So in the vortex, there is no superfluid. So
this is a point in which essentially
I don't know what.
So
there is another language in the literature, especially for atomic system. They call it soliton, and they say it is vortex with a zero circulation. Okay, so you could imagine that you have a wave turning like this, okay, and this forms a soliton because the Gross-Pitayevsky equation supports soliton, and there is a very good paper showing that in one dimension you can deduce a soliton behavior from just Gross-Pitayevsky equation. And in atomic physics, they call this soliton necklace. Okay.
But why do you have this dark region of optically inactive excitons?
Here?
Yes.
Those are classical. Those must be classical for the following reason. If you put numbers to see what energy you need to have the all the exciton outside of the cone, you find that the energy has to be of the order 0.1 MeV. But then, knowing the velocity of sound in gallium arsenide, they move faster than the velocity of sound. Now, this is not the Landau criterion, because Landau criterion will be the velocity inside this material. But if they move at velocity larger than the velocity of sound, they should be able to emit a lot of acoustic phonons. And therefore, they are not in a superfluid state. So in the dark region, I don't think they are in a superfluid state.
They are large K,
moving very fast.
Okay.
That's all. Okay. So that's why when I was showing my shit with this computer. Wait. I don't know why we pay Bill Gates for such a bad software. Okay, but I see at an optimal R, condition for this order state are realized. Okay. As an experimentalist, that's all I can say so far. I mean, everything else is speculation. Yeah. So there is a dark state here. Here they move faster than the speed of sound in gallium arsenide. So I don't see how they could be superfluid. Okay. And then there is a special distance where density, temperature, and so on are optimum. At this point, they go to velocity equal to zero because they emit light, and they all disappear. Which for me is, if it was not from some kind of a stimulated scattering, I don't see how they could disappear all suddenly. Okay, if it was just recombination, we should have some kind of a broad, the width of this ring should be much broader. There must be something that make them all go at once. Guys, if any one of you wants the data, I'm happy to send the data, and interesting to have all your comments. So the two I would say purely experimental paper I published in Nature in 2002, just a few weeks old.
What's the difference between the direct and the indirect excitons? Just the different dipole matrix elements?
And also because the indirect exciton is the lowest energy state, when you let them relax, the density of indirect exciton is about 10 to the 4 larger than the direct exciton. And the proof of this is that when you put yourself in a condition where you can see the direct and the indirect exciton, you don't see the direct exciton in photoluminescence.
How do you prepare different densities of direct and indirect excitons by pumping differently?
Two things. You pump, and you see here, for example, in this graph, there is only the indirect exciton luminescence. This is gallium arsenide. The direct exciton should be out here and nothing. Okay. And it's easy to do experimentally because you have two parameters on which you can play games. One is the laser intensity.
Right.
And the other one is the gate voltage. And I've shown you that if you change the gate voltage in the movie, so this is another one where you see this is the direct exciton, this is the indirect exciton, this is the gallium arsenide.
Right.
And as a function of position, this guy disappears within, I say, like 80 micron. There is something like 4 micron between each of those plots. And then this one is really far away. And let's go back to the movie.
But from the point of view of the possible superfluidity, the only difference is how fast they recombine, right? The direct one probably recombines faster.
And also how many you have of them. The density of direct exciton is never so large. Let's see the last, okay. So this is, of course, taken with much less spectral resolution, okay, because otherwise the CCD camera will not get a lot of photon. Although, you know, this was one thing also for me, the effects are all big effects. I mean, it's not something, where you have to really fight, and it's really big effect. It's the third set of measurements. So this is changing density. By the way, another thing to explain is this propagation front. I mean, there is clearly a front of exciton moving out from the excitation spot and going in the sample. Okay, the next one, Gabi, we change the gate voltage. So we go from direct exciton to indirect exciton once this guy is out.
How can I explain the position of this exciton core is always the same?
So let us first see. So now we're going to stop here. Okay, so now this is temperature. Sorry, next one. Let's wait 1 minute, and I answer the question after. This is also clear. You see how the exciton move farther and farther because the temperature become smaller. Okay, so this is versus gate voltage. You see what you change the gate voltage, you see the exciton, and then it disappear, and it collects here. So there is never any direct exciton appearing in the system. What was the question?
It seems that like position of the exciton core is always the same.
No. I've shown. Look at the second set of picture. We move the spot.
Yeah.
Okay. And the ring will follow the spot completely. So after this one, the next set of measurement. I'm sorry, I've not yet found a way to just extract whatever I want from the movie. Okay, it's almost done. Okay, so don't concentrate on the trap here, but concentrate on the ring. And you see that it moves with the excitation spot. This is the ring. Of course, out there is no more excitation. And then again, when this guy is going to be far away from the trap, it's going to start to move out. And you see the modulation. So the experiment where there is no traps, follow exactly the laser spot.
And how do you control temperature? Laser beam, does it bring some temperature?
Okay, so all the temperature I quoted was the lattice temperature. This is what we can measure. The temperature of the exciton gas at the excitation spot is most likely very high because we excite high on in the energy. But then since we can measure the position of the photoluminescence, we have a good idea of what is the temperature of the exciton. And in the external ring, they are, as much as we can say, exactly the temperature of the lattice. So they have cooled down in their travel out of the central spot.
Do you have an idea what will be the profile in K? That is, these are just the exciton which are colder because are far away from the spot. You can see because are colder, so you see just the ring, which is the ring of cold.
If it was only a ring, I will not be so intrigued. What really intrigued me is the shape of this ring. You see, because a ring, I will. You know, you can imagine, I don't know, some tricky lensing because you put a laser that is intense and therefore you change the refractive index. And I don't know, you could imagine many experimental, you know, artifacts. But then why is it so regular and so order? And why is the order following the laser spot? This is really if you ask me what is crucial in this experiment, it's the ordering on the macroscopic scale. And I don't want to say coherence because, again, if it's a classical, you know, all the Rayleigh-Benard, instability in classical fluid where you put temperature and you cool, there is also order pattern there. So it could be non-quantum mechanical, it could be classical, I don't know. Now, we are working very hard. As I said, we're going to lower the temperature. We have samples that are a bit better. We're going to make excitation at different levels. One experiment that I dream to do, I don't know if it is possible, it's to make an interference between, for example, the light coming from here and the light coming from here and see if the light is coherent. I don't know yet. That's a very, very difficult experiment. But
do you have any impurities? I mean, is there at all?
There is impurity that are most likely associated with those guys. But those guys are fixed. I can move.
But if you move the laser, I mean, do these things stay there? I mean, for
at the sample, no. Everything is extremely stable. We do the experiment, we warm up the sample, we come back 6 months after.
Our sort of vortices, I mean, could you pin them somewhere at an impurity? I mean, do you see any of that? I mean, if there's a vortex core or something like that, then you should be able to pin it.
Okay, there is something going on around those impurity, and if you look at the impurity, it's not the. If you really focus here with a much better spatial resolution, it's not just a spot. There is some spatial behavior, but I cannot. I mean, right now I don't have enough information to tell you what it is. One thing that is really amazing, you know, is we went to conference, Leonid went to do some ski and so on. You come back, the sample has been warm for 2 weeks, then you cool the sample and you get exactly the same thing. So it's not like the last Bell Lab result. You know, those are reproducible.
No, I understand. I mean, the only thing I'm interested in is basically, I mean, if you have these nonlinear things going on, either solitons or vortices or something of that kind, in a superfluid state, and you should be able to see some pinning energy. I mean, at impurities, and that would be sort of
okay,
an interesting thing to.
You're pushing me, Helmut. No. But you're right. What is being measured right now? Let's go back. Leonid is making experiments to see the motion of those guys when they get close or far from the impurities. and it seems that they are attracted by those.
I see.
Okay, now take this with a grain of salt,
sure.
Okay? Those are experiments that are being done now. Okay. So it's not a couple of weeks, it's just now.
Okay.
But we are planning to publish something where you can follow the trajectory, take one of those spots and see if it moves just radially or not. And it's not just, not radially, in fact, when there is one of those impurity, they meander around it.
Okay. The outer interest, it's static or could it rotate? I was wondering if you could take a laser, I mean, in one particular shape.
For all the excitation that are, you know, circular, they are just circular. So it's more the symmetry of the program is more like a ring. Now,
could this whole thing, this rotate?
How do you want to do this? If you want to put a magnetic field or?
Yeah.
Well, magnetic field has a very bad effect on exciton. It increases the mass of the exciton, the translation mass of exciton. So we are going to do the experiment, okay? We are going to put a magnetic field to see what is going to happen. The only thing that is out of the symmetry is the fact that the mesa is here. You can see clearly the edge of the mesa. And that's at the point where the ring is no more circular. Now, what you can see is here. Here you can see that it moves. Oh, by the way, that you remind me something important. Those guys repel each other because see when at this next one, it doesn't go to zero. It makes something like this. So when the two spots are a bit far from the other, it's like this and not this way. So when the two spots are not too far from the other, you have one big oval. So it seems that they are pushing each other. Okay. Diffusing and drift. Remember that the energy change. So as you have high density, there is also a change of energy. So it's both derivative of density, derivative of energy. Now
they are not moving in a ballistic way in any case.
You're asking me questions. I don't know how to answer this. Okay.
You're expecting the Bose condensation to move ballistically. So can you detect it, how fast it would take the front to reach the edge of the sample?
Okay, good question. We have not yet done time resolved experiment. So since my lab is specialized in time resolution, we plan to do time resolved experiment.
Okay. Yes.
All right. So thanks very much.
Yeah. Okay.